compensation, such as apartments or school tuition. Alan Weisselberg was subpoenaed in Letitia James's civil investigation and testified twice last year. His lawyer declined to comment when asked Tuesday if he had been subpoenaed to testify before the new grand jury. A message seeking comment was left with Jan Weisselberg's lawyer.
We get people.
U.S. agenda on Iran.
More than 4 months into the year 2021, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has failed to return to the internationally backed nuclear deal with Iran. While indirect negotiations continue, Washington is attempting to take the upper hand by demands that make no sense, considering the U.S. violation of the deal under former President Trump.
President Biden has been very clear in saying that if Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same thing.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. In this show, we will take an analytical look at the latest developments in relation to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. What could you expect to come out of the indirect talks in Vienna? Is the US ready to show some respect after violating the deal? We'll try to find out. Stay with us on We the People.
Our overarching goal is to ensure that Iran's nuclear program is permanently and verifiably constrained, and that on a permanent and verifiable basis, Iran will not be able to obtain a nuclear weapon.
Whether the Joint Commission's agenda produces a result or not depends on the Europeans and reminding the U.S. of its obligations and the Americans acting on their commitments.
The stakes are high as the U.S. hesitates to return to the deal. The outcome of the talks will determine not just the future of the dynamics between Tehran and Washington, but also the durability of security in the whole region. The U.S. industrial military is rarely ready to give an inch when it comes to its financial and adventurous interests, mostly under Israeli influence.
The cabinet is united in strongly opposing the proposed deal. This deal would pose a grave danger to the region and to the world, and would threaten the very survival of the state of Israel. The deal would not shut down a single nuclear facility in Iran, would not destroy a single centrifuge in Iran, and will not stop R&D on Iran's advanced centrifuges. On the contrary, the deal would legitimize Iran's illegal nuclear program. It would leave Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure.
In this case, Washington is refusing to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, although it had basically violated international law by withdrawing. Tehran has so far taken methodical retaliatory measures to respond to the U.S. isolationism within the JCPOA framework. We're now joined by Daniel Kovalik, author, peace activist, and professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Professor Kovalik, how do you think it's justified for the Biden administration not to lift the sanctions illegally imposed by former President Trump?
Well, I think it was wrong. I mean, I think he should have lifted sanctions right away and entered the nuclear deal that Trump backed out of, entered it without conditions. He hasn't done that. We'll see if he does enter that agreement again. I'm critical of that. I'm critical of the fact that he has continued to bomb Somalia, that he's continued to intervene in Syria. So he has a long way to go, certainly.
Many thanks for your insight, Professor Cavalli. Stay tuned.
Tehran has demanded that it would only reverse its remedial measures, the phased reduction of its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA, if the U.S. removes all sanctions together. The U.S., meanwhile, appears to be under Israel's pressure, as is the case oftentimes, to make sure the U.S. administration would not take any action against Tel Aviv's interests.
That has complicated the indirect Tehran-Washington talks even further. Israel has also been stepping up aggression against Palestinians. Tel Aviv has been pressuring the Biden administration through its lobbies in Washington to make sure Tehran cannot win its absolute right as defined in the nuclear deal. Our next guest is Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and a former US Marine intelligence officer. He's the author of the book Deal Breaker, Donald Trump and the Unmaking of the Iran Nuclear Deal. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Mr. Ritter, during the 2016 presidential election, then-candidate Joe Biden vowed to reverse Trump administration's aggressive policies, including foreign policy. How much of that do you think has materialized today? Do you see a major shift in foreign policy?
There's been actually very little separation in terms of operational impact. There's been a rhetorical difference. The President Biden has said things to our allies that that give voice to his intent to improve alliances and things of that nature, to rebuild alliances. But at the end of the day, there's been no major shift in foreign policy across the board.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Ritter.
The Israeli regime's aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian lands in the West Bank and elsewhere has also been affecting the dynamics of the Tehran-Washington standoff over the nuclear deal.
Of doing everything we can to make sure that Iran never acquires a nuclear weapon. An Iran with a nuclear weapon or with the capacity to have one on very short order is an Iran that's likely to act with even greater impunity when it comes to these other actions.
Republicans in Congress, for instance, believe that the Hamas resistance movement's retaliatory attacks to defend Palestinians in the face of Israeli aggression is a good reason to cease the talks in Vienna.
The Biden administration, meanwhile, voices mild opposition to the Zionist regime's military adventurism, but at the same time justifies its attitude and at times even aids and abets Tel Aviv. We're also joined by Sayed Mohammad Marandi, political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Marandi, is the U.S. and generally the West for that matter seeking to withhold Iran from economic prosperity? Why would a weaker Iran serve their interests better?
Western regimes have a general policy of making countries suffer if they do not abide by their demands and their orders. So the United States is imposing maximum pressure on Iranians to make the Iranian nation suffer as much as possible, to force Iran to abide by the will of the empire. But it's not just Iran.
Many thanks for your insight, Professor Marandi.
The U.S. long-lasting support for Israel is no big surprise. Under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime intends to make sure Iran's nuclear program is disrupted. Iran has been stepping up its nuclear program in return for the illegal sanctions imposed under former President Donald Trump.
Trump was pro-Israel in a more straightforward way. He was also anti-Iran in the same manner as the JCPOA had been negotiated under his nemesis, former President Barack Obama. Today, Biden has a tough job. He could continue pandering to Tel Aviv or just do the right thing in an effort to maybe restore some credibility for the United States' international pledges, such as sticking to a deal.
Again, all they would have had to have done is re-entered the agreement that President Obama had entered into, and they're not doing that. I mean, it makes you wonder whether they just are trying to buy time and that they really don't want to re-enter the deal. So that remains to be seen. I mean, I think that they would like to re-enter it on better terms than Obama did, if they can. And again, maybe they want to leave the option open of not returning to it at all and continuing the pressure on Iran.
As the U.S. procrastinates to return to the deal, the region of West Asia keeps grappling with upheaval and uncertainty. The manufactured crisis in the Middle East could end up with no victory in the U.S. foreign policy sector if the Biden team does not change its course. As Israel spares no efforts to sabotage the Iran nuclear program and negotiations, Tehran remains resolute in remarkable improvement of its nuclear might.
We just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radio isotopes needed for, you know, certain medical treatments. The letter and the DIQ has been sent today to the agency, and we would start this important job from tomorrow. Obviously, this is certainly according to our needs.
The former U.S. administration did its best to make a Biden return to the JCPOA next to impossible. And today, as Biden struggles to show a gesture to Iran, he has to deal with not just Israel, but also Trump's past shenanigans. How would the American people and international community feel if the U.S. illogical demands in the talks resulted in a dead end?
I'm not the most informed people when it comes to the realities of Iran, its nuclear program, and the efforts that have been underway for some time now to bring them under inspection-based controls. Indeed, the American people have been brainwashed with disinformation put forward by the United States, by the intelligence community in the United States, and by Europe and others who have been painting Iran as a nation that, at a very minimum, sought to acquire nuclear weapons. I mean, that's the accepted narrative today in the United States.
U.S. return to compliance with the nuclear deal is on President Joe Biden. As vice president of the Obama era, Biden played a key role in the 2015 agreement. But can he now bring the United States back to the deal amid the internal power play?
We're negotiating a plan that will have in it a capacity for enforcement. We don't even have diplomatic relations with Iran right now. And the senator's letter erroneously asserts that this is a legally binding plan. It's not. That's number one. Number two, it's incorrect when it says that Congress could actually modify the terms of an agreement at any time. That's flat wrong. They don't have the right to modify an agreement reached executive to executive between leaders of a country.
As the work on the restoration of the JCPOA continues, there are hopes that the long negotiations would bear tangible results that indicate respect for the Iranian nation. Throughout the 20th century, the U.S. has violated the rights of many nations. That has not changed today. The Biden administration's foreign policy apparatus is expected to consider U.S. reputation not just in regard to Iran, but the whole international community.
I think the international community knows quite well who's to blame. The Iranians have very simple expectations. The Americans abide by the deal in full, and then Iran will abide by the deal in full. In the past, that's not what happened. In the past, during Obama, the Iranians were committed to their side of the bargain, and the Americans weren't. During Trump, of course, it got even worse. So the world knows what's going on. But the problem is that the Western media is never going to condemn the United States. No matter what the United States does, it won't be condemned. There will be no real pressure on the country.
There are no grounds for the West's stated concerns about a nuclear Iran. Both under duress from sanctions and during negotiations, Tehran has always maintained that its nuclear program is merely peaceful. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, went as far as asserting in 2019 that Iran has always had the ability to tread this path, but we declared it haram according to the verdict of the beloved Islam. Assessments by Western monitoring organizations as well as spy agencies have corroborated the peaceful nature of the Iranian program, whereas unquestionably rogue regimes in the region pursue their aggressive and at times nuke-related agenda with impunity.
Well, from the Biden administration's perspective, these sanctions were not illegally imposed. The United States had every right to withdraw from the JCPOA. It was bad policy. But, you know, the JCPOA is not a lifelong commitment. Parties are able to withdraw, and the United States withdrew. And in doing so, liberated itself to impose, you know, whatever sanctions it saw fit on Iran. They're consistent with U.S. law. They might be in violation of the law in terms of international law, but even then, that's you know, up for debate.
One could say the Biden administration does not have much leverage with Iran. Tehran has already learned not just to survive, but to prosper despite brutal sanctions meant to cripple the Iranian nation. Biden knows that the previous administration stepped up pressure to the maximum to bring Tehran to its knees, but to no avail.
Today, the ball is in the court of the United States, and Washington has to return and fulfill its obligations.
Now that he is in power, the Democratic president has to realize that his chance for a foreign policy legacy in regard to Iran is short-lived, though currently up for grabs. Can he fight all the anti-Iran sentiments running rampant within the U.S. government and among some allies?
Nothing much has really changed. The United States has a tradition of having a rather stable foreign policy. Regardless of who's the president, the general world view of the United States doesn't really change. The United States considers itself to be exceptional. It considers itself to be superior, both morally and, of course, militarily and politically and economically than other countries. And therefore, they believe that they have special privileges and rights. So while they demand other countries to abide by international law, the United States never abides by international law.
From one perspective, the U.S. dilemma is not a huge one. Washington must simply opt for the right thing to do, which is a return to the JCPOA and removal of all illegal sanctions imposed by Trump.
Our position is very clear. Several countries had clinched an agreement with Iran. This was followed by a UN Security Council resolution. And from our perspective, this is a commitment from all the involved parties in this deal. If the Americans left this accord unilaterally and didn't see fit to deliver on their commitments, this, in our view, is a breach of the principles that are the norms of international behavior. Our view is that if the Americans have any claims on this issue, they have to return to 2015, which is when the accord was agreed on. We can start from there. So the Americans should lift all the imposed sanctions.
On tonight's episode of We the People, I am happy to be joined by Giorgio Cafiero. He is the CEO of Gulf State Analytics. Giorgio, thanks so much for joining us. I want to jump right into it. Negotiations around returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, has stretched on for weeks now, so far with little to show for it, although we've heard plenty of optimism from a number of involved parties. What is the latest here, and what are some of the domestic dynamics in the U.S. that may be complicating or slowing down any attempt to restore the nuclear deal?
Right now, I think we have an administration in the U.S. that genuinely wants to see a revival of the JCPOA. There are, you know, certain questions that are unresolved between the parties, mainly between the U.S. and Iran, about the timing. Obviously, Iran wants as much sanctions relief up front, whereas I think on the U.S. side, they want the sanctions relief to be more gradual, and they want to see it conditioned to certain moves on Iran's side. So we still don't know yet how the Europeans are going to be able to sort of bridge this gap. But nonetheless, I think both the leadership in the U.S. and Iran would like to see the JCPOA once again become an effective accord. However, the Biden administration has some real political headaches here in Washington. The Republican opposition to JCPOA is very, very strong. This nuclear accord has basically become an issue that divides American lawmakers along partisan lines. Republicans are pretty much united with the conviction, the belief that Donald Trump made the best decision in May 2018 when he pulled the U.S. out of the deal unilaterally. So we need to understand that, of course, the Biden administration has the authority to bring the U.S. back into the JCPOA. So this Republican opposition will not in itself block Biden from being able to make that move, but it does complicate the picture. And right now, as we're seeing the massacre that's taking place in Gaza, this violence in Palestine is now becoming increasingly connected to the JCPOA.
I think that's an important point, Giorgio. Could you elaborate on that at all? How exactly does the ongoing siege of Gaza by the so-called Israeli Defense Forces fit into the whole situation here?
The Israeli leadership is really worried about the geopolitical ramifications of a U.S. return to the JCPOA. The nightmare for Netanyahu's government is that tension could decrease between Washington and Tehran if there is a successful revival of the JCPOA. Just to be clear, if the U.S. comes back to the accord, there are still going to be many problems in the U.S.-Iran relationship. But nonetheless, we all know that if the JCPOA is salvaged, there's going to be a real opportunity for the two countries to try to move their relationship in a better direction, raising a specter of a real thaw in U.S.-Iran relations. A concern for the Israeli officials is that such a scenario would decrease Israel's strategic value to the United States. And we've seen numerous actions taken by the Israelis. So it's very easy to imagine the Israelis looking at the situation in Gaza as an opportunity to make it increasingly difficult and more politically costly for Joe Biden to do what he needs to do to bring the U.S. back to this accord that the U.S. entered back in 2015 after years and years of negotiations.
That is the only first step that could show a positive gesture to Tehran and indicate seriousness on the side of Washington to de-escalate tensions in the region. With the U.S. sticking to Trump's violation of law today, one could see there is not much difference between Republicans and Democrats, and the U.S. imperialistic agenda moves forward unabated no matter who is residing in the White House.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Say his name, said 7-year-old Gianna Floyd. In bright sunshine outside the West Wing of the White House, family members and lawyers raised their fists and said her father's name in chorus, George Floyd. They were marking exactly 1 year since the police murder of Floyd, an African-American man in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which shook America with months of nationwide protests against racial injustice and demands for police reform. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled, George Floyd Family Urges Biden to Pass Police Reform Bill as It Stalls in Senate. Say his name, said 7-year-old Gianna Floyd. In bright sunshine outside the West Wing of the White House, family members and lawyers raised their fists and said her father's name in chorus, George Floyd. They were marking exactly 1 year since the police murder of George Floyd, an African-American man in Minneapolis, shook America with months of nationwide protests against racial injustice and demands for police reform. On Tuesday, 25th of May, the Floyd family brought that conversation to Washington. Joe Biden, whose own family has been haunted by grief, apparently demonstrated an empathy many found lacking in his predecessor, Donald Trump, during a private meeting which lasted more than an hour. Floyd's brother, Philanese Floyd, described Joe Biden as a genuine guy and told reporters the family had a great discussion with him and Vice President Kamala Harris. They always speak from the heart, and it's a pleasure just to be able to have the chance to meet with them when we have the opportunity to, he said. According to a report, President Biden, who later traveled to Wilmington, Delaware to attend a funeral of a former staff member, reflected on the anniversary of George Floyd's murder. It takes a lot of courage to go through it, he said, of the Floyd family, and they've been wonderful. Asked about Gianna, Joe Biden said the first thing she did was run to him and give him a hug, then ask for snacks. Gianna had Cheetos and milk, he added before joking, "My wife's going to kill me." America's racial reckoning across business, culture, and society has not yet been matched by legislative action. President Biden had set a deadline of Tuesday for the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which contains reforms such as a ban on chokeholds, to become law. It passed the House of Representatives back in March, but is faltering in the Senate, where Republicans object to a provision ending qualified immunity, which shields police officers from legal action by victims and families for alleged civil rights violations. The Floyd family urged quicker action. Philanese Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, said pointedly, "If you can make federal laws to protect the bird, which is the bald eagle, you can make federal laws to protect people of color." Brandon Williams, George Floyd's nephew, added, "He let us know that he supports passing the bill, but he wants to make sure that it's the right bill and not a rushed bill." The family's lawyer, Ben Crump, said the group was about to meet Senators Cory Booker and Tim Scott, who are working on a bipartisan deal. "We all want just policing where George Floyd will get an opportunity to take a breath without having a knee on his neck," he said. "It has been 57 years since we've had meaningful legislation." Some observers have suggested that President Biden should use his position to push Congress harder. The anniversary came as a warning that patience could wear thin. The president, who made racial justice central to his election campaign and enjoyed strong support among African-American voters, issued a statement following the meeting with the Floyd family. The statement said, "The Floyd family has shown extraordinary courage, especially his younger daughter Gianna, who I met again today." The day before her father's funeral, a year ago, Jill and I met the family and she told me, "Daddy changed the world. He has." Joe Biden added that he appreciates the good faith efforts from Democrats and Republicans to pass a meaningful bill out of the Senate. "We have to act. We face an inflection point. The battle for the soul of America has been a constant push and pull between the American ideal that we're all created equal and the harsh reality that racism has long torn us apart." George Floyd died on 25th of May 2020, when the then Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for more than 9 minutes, despite the 46-year-old repeatedly saying he could not breathe. The killing, captured on video by a bystander, triggered months of demonstrations at systemic racism and policing. Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder and is waiting sentencing next month. George Floyd was honored across America on Tuesday, 25th of May. In Minneapolis, a foundation created in his memory organized an afternoon of music and food in a park near the downtown courtroom where Derek Chauvin stood trial. 9 minutes of silence were observed, and later, mourners gathered for a candlelit vigil. Barack Obama, the first black U.S. president, issued a statement that acknowledged hundreds more Americans have died in encounters with police, but also expressed hope. "Today, more people in more places are seeing the world more clearly than they did a year ago," Barack Obama said. "It is a tribute to all those who decided that this time would be different, and that they, in their own ways, would help make it different." Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader, noted how the stomach-churning video of George Floyd's death rippled beyond the United States. "The name of George Floyd was chanted in Rome, Paris, London, Amsterdam, Berlin, and Mexico City," Chuck Schumer said. "As recently as this weekend, professional soccer players in the English Premier League knelt before the game in support of the global movement against racism touched off by George Floyd. This was not only a fight for justice for one man and his family, who I've had the privilege to meet with, but a fight against the discrimination that black men and women suffer at the hands of state power, not just here in America, but around the globe." Earlier, the Floyd family had visited the Capitol in Washington, D.C. to push the police reform legislation in meetings with members of Congress, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Karen Bass, a Democrat and the lead House negotiator, renewed her commitment to compromise with Republicans. Karen Bass said, we will get this bill on President Biden's desk. What is important is that it's a substantive piece of legislation, and that is far more important than a specific date. We will work until we get the job done. It will be passed in a bipartisan manner. Legislation has been pursued in all 50 states in the U.S. and the District of Columbia to increase accountability or oversight of police officers. 24 states have enacted new laws.
Ministry.
Finally, the sound of warplanes, cannons, and missiles became silent in Palestine, giving room to the sound of politics. This does not mean that the battle is over, but rather that a new chapter of it may begin, but with different tools and methods. A chapter in which the resistance is fully prepared to deal with, whether through negotiations or in the battlefield, where it showed high readiness to repel any new Israeli aggression. In the meantime, behind Israeli closed doors, the situation is confused. Many questions were brought forward to the Israeli decision-makers' table about their failure, its causes, how to limit that failure and handle its repercussions, whether on the Palestinian front line or in more distant ones. Anyhow, Israel realizes that what comes after the sword of Al-Quds will not be the same as before it. Just as the resistance factions realize this, headed by Hamas, which began working on restoring its relations with Syria as part of the expected and feasible investment in the results of the last confrontation with Israel. As for the West Bank and the 1948 occupied territories, the Palestinian natives there will not be forced back into the Israeli occupation's tight grip, as the revolt sparked during the last week of Ramadan will not end soon. The results of the unparalleled confrontations inside occupied Palestine will not be easy to erase. Rather, it will dig deep, whether in terms of the unity amongst the Palestinian people or the confrontation with the occupation or even clashing with the Oslo Authority. Is this but one more cycle of Israeli violence exhibiting the unresolvable war between a native people overwhelmed by a colonial intruder emboldened by a unique religiously grounded settler sense of entitlement? Or are we witnessing the beginning of the end of the century-long struggle by the Palestinian people to defend their homeland against the unfolding Zionist project that stole their land, trampled on their dignity, and made Palestinians victimized strangers in what had been their national home for centuries? The answer is quite simple. What the latest round of Israel's incremental genocide have made clear is that Palestinians all across historic Palestine are withstanding prolonged oppression with their spirit of resistance intact and refuse pacification regardless of the severity of the imposed hardships. Yes, Palestine can and will be free. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Underlying the eruption of tensions between oppressor and oppressed all across Palestine, the lights have remained scandalously dim at the UN. Western leaders pathetically call for calm on both sides as if they are equal, while apparently affirming the one-sidedness of Israel's right to defend itself as if it had been attacked out of the blue. What the recent Israeli genocidal approach has made clear is that the Palestinians are withstanding prolonged oppression with their spirit of resistance intact and refuse pacification regardless of the severity of the imposed hardships. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Muna Issa, spokesperson of the Boycott U.S. Products Campaign and political commentator. Thank you very much, Muna, for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, as a spokesperson of the BUP, Muna, how relevant is your work to the confrontations that shook the entire world for the past 2 weeks?
It's very important to point out that
Israel is a proxy for the United States in the Middle East. As Joe Biden once said, if there wasn't an Israel in the Middle East, they'd have to create one. And so if we are taking a firm stance against Israeli war crimes in the region, is it logical to fund it? Mm-hmm. So here we talk about putting our money where our mouth is. So we encourage the boycott of United States products that support Israel as well as Israeli products. And such products are very prominent in today's international economy. We're talking about Starbucks, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Victoria's Secret, Estee Lauder. So these are just some of the most prominent products that are active supporters of Israeli apartheid war crimes. The United States every single year grants Israel $4 billion unconditionally, and these are made to support Israel militarily, diplomatically, and financially. This is other than the loans and the private companies that are actively supporting destroying Palestinian homes and building settlements and enforcing apartheid. So in order to take a stance against Israeli war crimes, it is very, very essential that we boycott products that support it.
Thank you for that. Muna, now, after 11 days of constant Israeli air raids against residential areas in Gaza, along with the clashes inside of the occupied Palestinian territories, which is a historic unilateral Israeli ceasefire, was announced at the end of last week. Now, both Zionists and pro-Palestinians are repeating the same thing, that if the ceasefire between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli army holds in this format that it is right now, then it will be a major blow to the actual existence of Israel. How do you think that is the case here?
It's the case here that for Israel to be pressured to have a ceasefire, it essentially means that it has met its match. So the fact that Israel, for the first time, it has actually worked in defending itself, this is a blow to the ego, other than other things. Here we could count at least three failures of the Israeli army and the governance. First of all, according to the Israeli population, the civilian population, despite all the military support and equipment, and despite all the international diplomatic support, Israelis were not able to protect their infrastructure and Israeli civilians from the Palestinian resistance rocket. And this is a blow to their security, because the very existence of Israel, the very basic tenet, is based on security. And once that is gone, well, almost all Israeli citizens have dual citizenships. They're going to pack their bags and go, because they've been promised the land of milk and honey. Mm-hmm. And so without that, Israel would be no more. So it was integrative that they
But the crucial point of what happened during May 21, 2021 in occupied Palestine is that all the regnant delusions that have driven the Israeli mentality and thinking for the past several decades were exposed. They're exposed that they are actually self-destructive. The political norms that they're using, despite the disaster that they have brought about, are still being exposed more than ever. How do you perceive the upcoming days and weeks in the internal Israeli-occupied cities, which have received probably the harshest blows by the resistance?
The Israelis have been very busy over the past few years in supporting Takfiri fighters in Syria, in engaging in peace deals with GCC countries, and working on having their existence shoulder to shoulder with Arabs and in normalization processes. This is in addition to their simulation and their repeated and perpetual ousting of Hezbollah also in Lebanon. So as you can see, Israelis have multiple enemies in the region, and they were not ready for any sort of resistance the same way that the same resistance that they encountered in Gaza. They were not fully focused and prepared for the Iranian support for the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, and therefore they were not ready to encounter that, let alone they're not ready for any sort of land invasion, and they're not ready for any sort of protests on multiple fields. And this is why this is a huge surprise to the Israelis.
Well, the record of struggles against colonialism since 1945 and up to 1948 when the occupation arrived support reaching the conclusion that the side that wins a legitimacy war will eventually control the political outcome anywhere, let alone in Palestine itself, despite being weaker militarily and diplomatically. This is going to the Palestinian side here. Is it safe to say that Israel has lost legitimacy war, and we are actually witnessing the last stand of settler colonialism inside of Palestine?
As long as you have factions and as long as you have civilians actively resisting occupation, it has been bound to its demise since the beginning. The Palestinian collective memory, cultural memory of itself, is reproduced throughout generations, and this is something that they found really shocking in the recent protests. The unity that not only did they find the unity inside Palestinian land, but they found it internationally more than ever, and this was very unprecedented. Even people who did not have much of a clue of what is going on in Palestine are now asking the real questions. Every image, every video, and every quote and article, it reached all four corners of the earth. And what constitutes legitimacy is public opinion. And so public opinion is swayed personally, on a personal level. When I found people who once supported right-wing fascist organizations, all of a sudden they are calling Israel an apartheid state, that's when I knew that the legitimacy war is in our favor.
Well, that's for us to hope. For the Palestinians to make this movement more powerful, to liberate their land, hopefully. Thank you very much, Muna Issa, spokesperson of the Boycott U.S. Products campaign and a political commentator, for joining us to talk about this matter, the matter of tensions increasing inside of the occupied territories inside of Palestine. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking with Manuel Oxenreiter about how the Israelis failed in all the strategy they put forward against Palestine. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
No one in the Israeli entity expected what came along at the hands of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. All talk about estimates and expectations lost its credibility with the first rocket launching towards occupied Al-Quds shortly after the threat of the leader of the Qassam Brigades, Abu Khaled al-Daif. Israel indeed faced a torrent of surprises, not only related to the ability of the resistance to launch large missiles that touched down deep within the entity, rather how the Palestinians of the occupied interior worked in harmony with Gaza. Israel loses military upper hand in this following report.
No one in apartheid Israel expected what the Palestinians were able to achieve in the past 2 weeks. This disbelief alone represents the level of crisis in Israel. The crisis of the Zionist political, military, and intelligence mind. The crisis of uncertainty about what might emanate from the other side. It is the same crisis that existed with Lebanon for many years, and it worsened with Gaza a few years ago, before its sheer size became crystal clear with the outbreak of the recent military confrontation. The first surprise was for the resistance to initiate war. And from where? From the blockaded Gaza Strip, besieged from every corner. Then was the unprecedented military security and political pressure against Israel from the majority of the regional and international states who are all facing multiple hardships due to the exacerbation of the global economic crisis and the spread of the corona pandemic. The Israeli occupation did not expect that the Gaza Strip would initiate such a step. If the Zionist regime had the lowest security or political regard, it would have acted in a different way in managing the case of ethnic cleansing in the Arab neighborhoods of East Al-Quds. However, the Gaza Strip initiated a qualitative step that made the enemy lose what had always distinguished it, which is the element of surprise resulting from its superiority in initiating wars. It is enough for the Israeli occupation to monitor the performance of the resistance in Gaza to start all new different calculations that involves other fronts of resistance, especially the Lebanon front, which has learned enough from Gaza's last lesson to reconsider many matters regarding confrontation with the enemy, not related to conventional deterrence, but rather to the combat doctrine based on the principle of defensive attack and preventive attack. Confronted with what Gaza had achieved, Israel was facing a flood of surprises not only related to the ability of the resistance to launch large missiles that reached deep within the entity. Rather, the Palestinians' response to the rocket fire went beyond ceremonial solidarity, as they usually do, to the limits of direct engagement in a confrontation that broke all the monotony that had occurred over a decade in the occupied West Bank and the 1948 territories. Israel did not expect that a new generation of Palestinians would emerge in popular movements interspersed with ferocious protests against the occupation forces. Within a few days, Israel was facing a different kind of crisis: the inability to control the Palestinian scene in the West Bank, where the Palestinian Authority cannot exercise exceptional repression, and it knows that its problem as an authority cooperating with the occupation has become greater than ever before.
To discuss this issue with us from Berlin is Manuel Oxen, writer, who is editor-in-chief of the Zurist magazine. Thank you very much for being with us, Manuel. Now, with the announcement of a ceasefire without a complete agreement between the Gaza Strip and apartheid Israel, renewed escalation might not be far from happening, and we did see a bit of escalation in Al-Aqsa, in the occupied Al-Quds today. Can Israel handle another round of Gaza rockets on the occupied cities with harmonious clashes inside of the occupied territories, whether in the West Bank or the 48 territories?
Well, as you correctly say, we speak about a ceasefire, a truce, and we don't speak about peace. And of course, we are not speaking about any kind of agreement for the future. How does it come to a truce or to a ceasefire in the conflict? It comes to this because both of the parties, they need a break. And I think that is what we witness now in this, in the latest conflict. But what should we see? We see that Israel has suffered a tremendous loss. And with this loss, I mean, this is the magic spell of a so-called wonder weapon, which was called the Iron Dome. For a long time, the Iron Dome was really promoted like a super wonder protective weapon, and the Palestinians indeed managed to simply to put the Iron Dome at its limit. So I think that is important. Then we have to see that we have two totally different war economies when it comes to Israel and the Israeli forces and to the Palestinians. We have with Israel a super progressive and highly technological army, a very expensive army, by the way, which can be only active and where the maintenance can only be done with huge foreign payments. I was just checking, so we, for the year 2019, they were going 3.8 billion only US American taxpayers' money, mainly in military help for Israel. So on the other side, we have the Palestinians, which are fighting mainly also with manpower. What they have for the Palestinians, they are used to losses also. For the Israelis, every loss is a big, not just a human loss, it is also a symbolic loss. So we see right now that there is a break, but it's for sure not the end of the war. We witness now a truce, a break. Maybe there will be some talks, but seeing the last decades of this conflict, I have my doubts.
Well, faced with a glorious scene of resistance, if I may, inside of Palestine, Israel is struck again with a recurrent question of what can be done. all talk about the Israelis' attempts to achieve military victories in the Gaza Strip. We're talking about 250 kilometers open-air prison in Palestine, in southern Palestine. And they express a lack of understanding of the reality. Still, with that small place, the existing reality of equations inside of Palestine, inside of Gaza, and around it. What options does apartheid Israel really have right now to try and deal with a new movement, with a new liberation movement inside its own territories?
That is one of the main problems for Israel. The time is running. That simply the time is running, also in terms of demography for Israel. So they cannot compensate. They simply cannot compensate the growing Arab population in their own territory, and of course also the growing ultra-Orthodox Jewish population, which refuses to take arms and refuses to serve in the army. So Israel is at the point where they can do, I mean, pragmatically seen, two choices. You can do the choice of de-escalation and go into agreements and go into serious talks. This is the one way. And there is the other way, to go into a total escalation. Unfortunately, for now, it looks like they chose the way of the total escalation. But as you said in your question, when Israel is, what are these victories? When they are celebrating victories, I think that was the term. These are no real victories, because in 2, 3, 4, maybe in 5 years, the situation is again the same. The problem is simply for Israel that they have an opponent. If they cut one, to say it like this, two others are coming. They have this problem, and this problem can only be solved with a real peaceful solution on the one side, or with going berserk on the other side, which really going into genocidal brutality. For now, it looks like there are both forces even present in Israel, but for now it looks also like that the second, the violent part, that they are playing.
And this is exactly what I want to point out to right here, especially in the occupied 1948 territories. Israel attempted to create some sort of a balance of terror by allowing and even protecting illegal colonial settlers to go and create all sorts of havoc and violence, and even in some sort of a gang logic against the native Palestinians, in parallel with widespread arrests inside these occupied territories, especially of Palestinian activists and mostly the participants in the pro-Palestinian protests that happened during the past 3 or 4 weeks. This is where the new wave of the Palestinian liberation is hitting the hardest. But how much of a risky game is Israel playing here?
As I said, the time is running, and we shouldn't underestimate. I mean, it is for if I would have an advice to the Palestinian side, it would be never underestimate the opponent. And Israel has still two very important strategic advantages when it comes to this conflict. And the first strategic advantage is the absolutely extremely professional lobbying Israel is doing, especially in Europe and of course in North America. As I said in the answer of the first question, Israel couldn't act as it acts if there wouldn't be the foreign support. Israel is not generating the means, the money, whatever they need to defend their society and of course also to keep the high living standard of their society. They are not generating it by themselves. They need a constant influx of foreign help. For this, they are absolute masters of foreign lobbying. This is number one. And here is the time also running. Just in one sentence, we have a destabilization right now in North America, at latest since we had the Trump government. And we have a destabilization, don't forget this too, also in Europe. The hit the COVID measures we're giving to Europe, this is all affecting also the economic capacities of Europe. So we see that the partners of Israel are getting weaker. The second thing, what we shouldn't forget, and I think that is also an important point in this context, is that Israel has a very, very sophisticated way of regional intelligence. I'm not speaking of the global intelligence, what of course is also good, but they have also a regional intelligence, and they are successful in dividing and fragmenting the opponent's camp. I'm not telling him this any news, but as long as Israel manages also to divide, to fragment and to bring Palestinian groups against other Palestinian groups. Mm-hmm. That is the way, I think, for Israel right now. These are the last real advantages they have, and they are, of course, also